forms of representation of the other, of the East, of the Orient, worked according to a set of oppositions. In every way, they were constructed as the complete opposite of one another, and in every case, the positive aspects were associated with the West and the negative aspects were associated with the East.
The Orient, the mysterious East, a place of fantasy, imagination, desire. This Orient has been created by the West, by artists, thinkers, dreamers, and adventurers. It gives fantastic expression to some reality that Europeans either wanted to possess or feared. Fabulous names, Harun al-Rashid, Omar Khayyam, Shahrazad. Fabulous places, Samarkand, Arabia Felix, Jerusalem the Golden. The lure of Jerusalem is uniquely powerful. It evokes the idea of the fabulous Orient, but it is also of the deepest significance to Muslims, Jews, and Christians. Usually, the Arab is represented as the other, deviant or excessive, less trustworthy, less human. One important function of these images is, I believe, that they justify the use of Western power to seek control over the East and to possess its riches.
Say, for example, that the great Bar Hebraeus, he speaks of this famous Syriac scholar of the 13th century. He says the great Bar Hebraeus was a genius of no parallel to him. But of course, that's because he is the son of a Hebrew, see, which is really a problem, meaning to say that if he were not a son of a Hebrew, if he were a son of an Arab, he would have given him a different status.
Orientalism was translated into 26 languages, sparking debates, and had many supporters and critics. The main reason why colonial effects remain in the colonies is that the eastern countries do not have a proper knowledge of themselves, and everything they know as history are the texts and opinions of Western Orientalists.
You take the modern Arab intellectual now, or the Muslim intellectual in general, when they want to talk about their own history, because they haven't done their homework, at the very end of the day, they go and quote what Grunenbaum had said, what Brockelmann had said, what summarized it for them, and hence they are still interpreting their own history through the eyes and through the visions of the Orientalists mainly German.
Though at the time I wrote, for example, The Question of Palestine, there were no histories of Palestine. I mean, I had to reconstruct the history, partly. Well, I had to deconstruct the official history that one saw in the Western press and in Western scholarship.
Said noted that the making of knowledge for the purposes of re-describing or reconfiguring the history of Islamic civilization altogether is a very important subject because language matters. How you describe your own history matters. And hence these people, these Orientalists, they are configuring for us the history and the intellectual history of Islamic civilization, and hence we are dependent on them.
The Iranian Revolution in 1979 was significant in my view. It was not violent, and a relationship was formed between the people and the religious leaders during the revolution, which in my opinion had a new meaning for the West. But the American media showed the Iranian revolution differently from what it really was, in line with the U.S. government's policies to show a violent image of Islam.
And eventually, the inheritor of Iran.
He defended the Islamic revolution by critiquing the American media, how it dealt with it.
Some 60 Americans, including our fellow citizen whom you just saw, bound and blindfolded, are now beginning their sixth day of captivity inside the U.S. Embassy in Tehran.
The story of 1979 U.S. Embassy takeover in Tehran mobilized all Americans against Iran. But despite the heavy atmosphere against Iran in the United States, my opinion did not change at all. In my opinion, the story of the embassy was in fact the retaliation of the Iranian people on the U.S. for all the calamities that imperialism and colonialism had inflicted on them. And this had nothing to do with Islam. Although I was a Christian, I could not remain silent in the face of this inverted propagation of Islam. All of these issues led me to write the book Covering Islam in 1981, and in a subheading I wrote, How the Media and the Experts Determine How We See the Rest of the World. The main subject of the book was about the takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. I explained there how the American media, even the biggest and most influential, tried to lead the American public opinion to hate Iranians by big lies.
It seems the Iranian students have the initiative. The next move is evidently up to the United States.
Our destiny was tied to war, and 1982 Lebanon War reminded us of that destiny again.
For years, we had heard it said that we were the ones who were trying to drive the Jews into the sea. And here, before the world's eyes, could be seen the spectacle of Palestinians being sent out into the sea, further away from the land that they came from.
Israel invaded Lebanon. In the years after the Six-Day War, Beirut became a gathering place for Palestinian immigrants and militants, and Palestine Liberation Organization members lived in Beirut too. My family had migrated to a village around Beirut many years ago due to my father's health problems and stayed there. Israel, which considered itself stronger after the Six-Day War, decided to invade Lebanon. I was doing my day-to-day tasks in New York when I suddenly noticed the news of the Israeli attack on television. My old mother was in Beirut, and I was worried.
I mean, the Palestinian presence in Beirut from the early 70s, for about a decade, from the early 70s to the early 80s, was the first time, I would say, in our national existence when we had, in fact, constituted a kind of substitute or ersatz Palestine.
After the occupation of Lebanon, I increased my activities against Israel, having interviews and writing articles. In the same year, I wrote the screenplay for the documentary The Shadow of the West. In this text, I connected my theory with political activities. My main point was the same thing that I wrote in Orientalism, but this time considering Palestine. The main point was how the Orientalist view of the Europeans led them to support the creation of Israel.
Sooner or later, all Arab countries gained independence. All except Palestine. Today, for the Jews who settled in Palestine and founded the State of Israel, the land is theirs.
Zionism is appears to be a movement and an ideology that sort of gathered together the remnants and the kind of remains of a shattered community of people who had historically been oppressed and abused and discriminated and persecuted in the West, and gather them together into a very powerful movement, which created a new country. It had all the elements of a kind of phoenix, you know, rising from the ashes. And it also had the appeal of the creation of a new state, which is, I think, very central to the European consciousness. Because, you know, a lot like, for example, the American experiment of Europe, that is to say, sending out people to America to create a new country. And obviously it explains the peculiarly close connection between America and Israel.
But in other times, the power of this idea moved armies and whole nations. Nine 900 years ago, Christian Europe decided to reclaim the Holy Land, Western Christianity's Holy Land, from the Saracen Muslims. After the Turks were defeated in 1917, the Europeans moved in. Britain and France created a new map dividing this region into protectorates, mandates, and spheres of influence. The names of the officials who first drew that map, Mark Sykes and Georges Picot, still resound throughout the Arab world. It is the map which essentially endures today, with one exception, the country of Palestine. In 1917, Arthur James Balfour stood at the pinnacle of the British imperial establishment. Shortly after Sykes and Picot drew their map, he wrote a letter that was to become famous as the Balfour Declaration. In it, he promised a Jewish homeland in Palestine.
I was blacklisted as an anti-Israel professor because of my type of work. But they were not satisfied with that, and my office was vandalized and set on fire at Columbia University in 1985.
The worst aspect of it is, of course, the occasional threat of violence. I mean, my office has been raided and vandalized. I've received death threats and phone messages that are, you know, quite unpleasant. So there's that. I mean, there's the hint of violence around there.
Well, yeah, I think that was... He lived with it constantly. I mean, one of the interesting things is that he was so powerful a presence that they couldn't really touch him. You know, it's not that they didn't try, constantly tried. When there's so much public relations on one side, you can't avoid public relations if you're going to have any chance at all on the other side. And Edward was a sort of a single public relations machine because he was such an appealing person and so knowledgeable and so cultured, and he understood Western culture. He was steeped in it, the music and the literature and so on. And so he couldn't be dismissed.
In 1986, I wrote the book After the Last Sky, and its title was based on the poem of my friend, the famous Palestinian poet, Mahmoud Darwish. The photographs in this book were the work of a Swiss photographer named Jean Moore. The book was about the real life of the Palestinian people before and after the occupation, a fact that the Western media was afraid to show. The anger of the Palestinian people arose in 1987. An Israeli truck ran over and killed several Palestinian workers, and several similar incidents took place in those days. People stood up against the aggressors empty-handed and with stones. The Intifada had begun, and there was a gleam of hope. Certainly, I was a supporter of such an event. I saw such power among the young people who started the Intifada, which showed that no matter how hard they tried to get rid of the name of Palestine, the nation was still alive. The Iraq-Kuwait War in 1990 cost Iraq heavily, and Palestinians suffered as well. The war caused severe divisions in the Arab world. Some Arab government officials were influenced by Saddam's slogans and supported him. Yasser Arafat was one of them. He even visited Saddam shortly after the invasion of Kuwait. It was here that I strongly opposed Arafat. In my opinion, Saddam was just a horrible and a vampire of a dictator. I felt that Arafat was walking on a dark path. Now, Arafat, who was tired and hopeless, had to pay a heavy price for the conflict, and the negotiation table was the best place for the West to take revenge.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qomi. Stay tuned.
از کلمات حکمت آمیز حضرت این جمله است کم من صائم.
Among the beautiful statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find a sentence about the quality of the fasting of the people. Imam Ali states, there are so many people who fast, but their fasting is only hunger and thirst. This sentence of Imam Ali alayhi salam means that some people only fast to be hungry and thirsty, and their fast do not include any other dimensions of their spiritual life. Also, we can find in many different narrations the classifications of fasting. In all these narrations, the best type of fasting is fasting of thought and mind. Also, it is said that it is better for a person to have the fasting of the body organs. In other words, not eating and drinking, although important, is the lowest level of fasting. It is very much recommended to fast with all our spirit and body. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qomi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, 14 unrecommended actions for a faster. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. Brothers and sisters, we know that while we're fasting, and let's talk about the jurisprudential fasting, the very bare bones, basic level, you know, beginner's level fasting. There are some do's and there are some don'ts, and there are rulings about it that we all are expected to know. Now, I wanted to today list some unrecommended actions, you know, other than those rulings of do's and don'ts, you know, the wajibs and harams, you know, things that validate or invalidate a fast. We're not talking about that. We're talking about some unrecommended actions, which we have been reminded of by Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam not to perform while we're fasting. Number one is dispute, argue and swear. Now, we know that, you know, sometimes we're not in the best of the moods, especially if we're hungry and thirsty, right? So it's easy or comparatively easier to get into disputes. Well, avoid that. Two is reading poems except for Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. Three is kissing, touching, and foreplay with one's spouse. Now, it may not be haram, you know, we're not going in that direction. And for that, you have to look at the jurisprudential rulings. We're just saying that don't open up that door. Number four is brushing teeth without a wet toothbrush. Number five is using eye makeup or eye drops. You know, it's not recommended. Unless, of course, you know, there's a medical condition. Number six, rinse out the mouth. You know, don't just do it, you know, periodically, except for wudu, of course. That's where you have to do as a mustahab act. But other than that, you know, try to avoid such a situation. Number seven is giving blood or anything which makes the faster weak. Now, again, the exceptions are there. You know, if somebody is dying, of course, save them. But generally speaking, you know, these are the unrecommended acts that we would like to remind you and ourselves of. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the 17 unrecommended actions for a faster. And this is different from what you may find in the do's and don'ts of the fasting. Number eight is inhaling where one does not know if it reaches the throat. You know, again, avoid such a situation, inhaling anything of some sort. Number nine is smelling of flowers, especially narcissus. You know, this, yes, you can smell, you know, it's you would like to smell a nice flower, but while you're fasting, try to avoid such a situation. Number 10 is enema with solid. Number 11 is making your clothes wet. Number 12 is sitting in the water for women. Number 13 is having a full stomach for those excused from fasting. You know, sometimes because of valid reasons, Islamic jurisprudence allows you not to fast, but then in that state, while you're not fasting, you should still respect the month of Ramadan. Fine, you had a valid excuse, but don't just roam around and eat in front of other people or, you know, eating full, you know, stomach full. These are some things which should be avoided. Last but not the least is troubling your worker or family. I think this is probably one of the most frequent scenes that we get to see during the holy month of Ramadan, because the routines have changed, because, you know, we're thirsty, we're hungry, we're lethargic, we're tired. You know, in some cases, we just want to go and sleep and doze off, but, you know, we're at work. So this is where you have to be careful, right? Be extra careful not to trouble your worker or another family member or a friend. These are some of the unrecommended actions that we wanted to remind ourselves and you of. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
More than 5 dozen advocacy groups have pressured Congress to cut off U.S. military support for the Saudi-led war and blockade on Yemen, highlighting that it has helped cause the death of nearly 500,000 people and pushed millions more to the edge of starvation. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading Coalition Demands End to U.S. Military Support for Saudi-led War on Yemen. Here's the story. More than 5 dozen advocacy groups have recently pressured Congress to cut off U.S. military support for the Saudi-led war and blockade on Yemen, highlighting that it has helped cause the death of nearly 500,000 people and pushed millions more to the edge of starvation. The group's letter to Congress, led by Churches for Middle East Peace, Demand Progress, Friends Committee on National Legislation, FCNL, Move On, Queen's Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and Yemen Relief and Reconstruction Foundation, comes in the midst of a 2-month truce. The signatories are calling on lawmakers to co-sponsor a forthcoming War Powers Resolution from Representatives Pramila Jayapal and Peter DeFazio, declaring that Congress must reassert its Article 1 war powers, terminate U.S. involvement in Saudi Arabia's war and blockade, and do everything it can to support the Yemen truce. Hassan Atayeb, Legislative Director for Middle East Policy at FCNL, said in a statement recently that the recently announced nationwide truce between Yemen's warring parties offers hope that an end to the 7-year conflict might finally be possible. Congress must help prevent backsliding by Saudi Arabia, which has driven so much of the violence through indiscriminate airstrikes and crippling blockade by passing the Yemen War Powers Resolution and blocking U.S. military support for any renewed hostilities, he added. Congressional pressure is critical right now to keep the warring parties at the bargaining table and off the battlefield. A coalition led by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates began waging war on Yemen when then-US President Barack Obama was in office and continued to do so throughout the former President Donald Trump's tenure. When President Joe Biden took office, he committed to ending U.S. support for the Saudi-UAE-led coalition's brutal war on Yemen, noted Demand Progress foreign policy campaigner Kavan Kazagurian. Unfortunately, the U.S. continues to provide critical support for the coalition's war effort and blockade, which has led to one of the world's worst humanitarian crises, he added. As the letter lays out, in February 2021, Biden announced an end to U.S. participation in the Saudi-led coalition's offensive operations in Yemen. Yet the United States continues to provide spare parts, maintenance, and logistical support for Saudi warplanes. The administration also never defined what offensive and defensive support constituted, and it has since approved over $1 billion in arms sales, including new attack helicopters and air-to-air missiles. This support sends a message of impunity to the Saudi-led coalition for its bombardment and siege of Yemen. With continued U.S. military support, Saudi Arabia escalated its campaign of collective punishment on the people of Yemen in recent months, making the start of 2022 one of the deadliest time periods of the war, the letter points out, adding, earlier this year, Saudi airstrikes targeting a migrant detention facility and vital communications infrastructure killed at least 90 civilians, wounded over 200, and triggered a nationwide internet blackout. Representatives for groups that signed on to the letter expressed disappointment with the current administration. Although President Biden initially seemed to signal that he would end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, it has become clear that his administration is not committed to constraining Saudi aggression, said Anil Shaleen, a research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, adding, if it were, we should have observed Saudi airstrikes on Yemen decline under Biden and instead they have risen. U.S. support for the Saudi war continues despite a growing recognition that the U.S.-Saudi relationship is deeply dysfunctional and fails to serve U.S. interests, she added. For this reason, it is imperative that Congress pass a war powers resolution to remind the executive branch of Congress constitutional authority and role as a voice for the American people. Sarah Lee Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, DAWN, also emphasized the responsibility of Congress, noting that from Obama to Trump to Biden, successive administrations have skirted our Constitution to pursue the war in Yemen without seeking congressional approval. This ill-considered venture has led not only to devastating consequences for Yemen's people, but endangered our military forces and our nation, making us legitimate targets for counterattack, she said. It's time to put an end to short-sighted, reckless miscalculations on the decision to go to war. We need to reaffirm this decision must always rest in the hands of People's Congress by passing the Yemen War Powers Resolution.
Thank you.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars, IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion, discussing the concept of Al-Quds Day, are two important guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Yasser Ibrahim and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
And Brother Yasser Ibrahim, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, thank you.
So, Al-Quds Day, the last Friday of the month of Ramadan, which was named, by the late Imam Khomeini, after the Islamic Revolution of Iran took place in Iran, but this concept nowadays can be witnessed all around the world. I think strategically, this land is also important, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, but because it's a sacred land, as Brother Yasser Ibrahim said, the sacred place, the sacred land. But the case is that I think this movement is not an anti-Semitic one, because sometimes they criticize this movement of being anti-Semitism or Semitic. This is not anti-Judaism. No, this is anti-oppression. Of course, we can call it anti-Zionism, because inside Judaism we have so many critics about Zionism and the oppressions that they do all around the world too. But for sure, this is an anti-oppression strategy that was taken. That was done by Imam al-Khomeini at that time. And also the leader, Imam Khomeini, is also after it. You said day by day Israel and the Israeli power is, getting weaker and weaker, Sayyid Mohsen. But we could see that the oppression all across the world is being expanded. I mean, at that time was Palestine, maybe South Africa and other countries. The colored people were oppressed on that time, the minorities all around the world. But nowadays we could see that in the Middle Eastern countries or in some of the African countries, African continent countries, some countries are really oppressed under the bombardment. Even in Shahr Ramadan, we could see the killing, the mass killing, the bombardments last year, and it's going on. So how is this power is getting weakened,
Well, obviously, we know that when a person is injured, for example, there's a fight between two people,
yes,
they're battling with sword or anything, the person who gets injured a bit or who knows that he's about to die, he puts all his efforts and all his struggle in order to have the last attack on the enemy or the other person. Same is the case with the Zionist regime. Because Zionist regime know that in the Holy Land, the Palestinian in the Palestinian land, they cannot have any more existence. So, in order to deviate the minds of people,
that's right.
Obviously, when we look at the Muslim countries, when we look at the Yemen, we look at the Pakistan or other places where we have the terrorist attacks, like bombing in the mosques.
Yes.
In Afghanistan, we have seen again in the month of Ramadan,
Just
last
Shia,
year
yeah.
there was a, yeah. it was happening in the school, this year again in a school and
school,
in the mosque,
right.
The both places. So what are these things? These are basically they're trying to deviate the minds of people from, getting away from the topic of Israel and get involved into their own topics. So obviously we know that these are backed by some superpowers. Some other Western countries, for example, America is backing up all these things. So it is not only done by Israeli regime. But on the other hand, if you look at the newspaper, the headings that we have, the local news in the, Israeli land, they're talking about the, end of the Zionist regime in Israel.
Okay.
They say we cannot live anymore. One of the analysts, he said that, that how can we claim that we will have the Israel as the land, whereas those who came to live in Israel, they have dual nationality. So there is a new discussion in the Zionist regime that those who are migrating from different parts of the world and they're coming into the occupied land of Palestine as the member of Zionist regime, they should not have dual nationality. They should have only one nationality, and that should be for the occupied land. So that in this way, they know that they're not going back. Whereas we know that these people have dual nationality. Whenever something something happens,
that's right.
they just run away.
Yes.
They just leave the country.
Yes.
So, you know, even the enemies know this. So these old things tells us that, obviously, they are getting weaker and weaker. And especially, you know, when they came into the power, they had victory on the Egyptians.
Yes.
At that time.
Yes.
But later we can see, like in 2006, the war between the Lebanon and the, you know, the Zionist regime, how Hezbollah won the battle.
Yes.
And this is a story. This is obviously something, a lesson for us, that we should know that, according to the, you know, the famous saying of Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, that it is weaker than the house of the, you know,
a spider.
Yes.
So even we have seen that a couple of years ago, the Supreme Leader also said, like, you will not see Israel in next 25 years.
Okay.
So all these things, it shows us, obviously, we believe in all this, and this is the promise of Allah.
That's all right. And why is it now more important than ever, I mean, than past? I mean, resistance against Israel and protecting the people of Palestine. Because I think that during all these years, so many people at first maybe did not believe in such a resistance, power, and movement. But nowadays we could see that on last Friday around the world, these rallies and demonstrations are held, even in the Western countries, okay? Even in the countries that back Israel. So why do you think, Brother Yasser Ibrahim, it is more important than ever, I mean, now at this time? I mean, in the geopolitical scene of the world nowadays.
I think the Israeli or the Palestinian issue has become a humanitarian issue. It's not just a religious issue. Myself, I was not born at that time. Said was probably not born at that time when Imam gave that edict in 1979. But before then, what I heard, what I've spoken to, is like Palestine was a forgotten issue. Before then, like after the Six-Day War, which was a massive loss for the Muslims. I mean, it was actually 5 days, but still. That war that lasted for, 5 days, when the three Arab states were defeated by the small entity within the Mitz. That time, it was a forgotten issue. So the reviving of it was important, first of all.
That's
Imam
right.
Khomeini revived it. When people had just forgotten what was happening, it was happening. And then, right now, it grew. Every year it grew. Why it may be more important now is because what Sayyid mentioned is that it is a wounded animal. It is just flaying and flashing whenever it can at this moment in time. It now does not have the upper hand as it did previously. It may not have the upper hand. It may not have as many supporters as it did previously. Unfortunately, we see certain Arab states now trying to become friendly with it again because of that particular issue. Now, why are you becoming friends again with a country that for its entire existence you resisted it? But now we see certain countries, and maybe we'll ask about them later on, they have signed treaties or pacts or coalitions. Why?
Yeah, they established ties with Israel.
Exactly.
Now the friendly ties, that's right, the Muslim.
Exactly.
Ties.
So okay. Three or four of these Arab countries, we won't
yes,
call
yes.
them Muslim countries, we call them Arab countries.
Yes.
There's a difference.
Okay.
Right, these Arabs, or these Arab countries that are Muslims. And the people may not have been happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
The people within those countries may not have been happy with it, but that's another discussion. But why it is important now is it may be forgot because, like, you have an upper hand now. You are showing that, you know, there are people throughout the world who, you know, it is more than just a religious issue now.
Yes.
It has gone beyond that. It is a human issue where people throughout the world, I think they know that this is wrong. You know, you cannot just go and steal someone's land because you feel it is yours. You cannot just occupy someone else's home. There was this video on Instagram or somewhere, they played it, where this Zionist goes and he tells the family, if I don't take you home, someone else will.
Oh.
It was quite... that causes more, you know... People now, because of social media and stuff, see more things.
Yes.
More things are being seen. And before, things were not as seen as much as now. So people are seeing things, people are looking at things, people are seeing a different aspect of things. News are coming out. And I remember Sayyid Khamenei, Hafizahullah, said something very, very, very nice, if you want to say. He says, at the beginning, the Palestinians were throwing stones at tanks. And now they're shooting rockets at it.
Yes.
You know, it shows that, okay, what there was and what there is, that you don't have the upper hand as you think you do anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the importance is this, is that to show that, look, you had the upper hand once upon a time. That time is gone. That time is finished. It is now time for the decline.
But the thing that you talked about the Arab lands and the Arab countries, you know, this resistance against Israel in protection of the Palestinians has a general message, and that is the defense of the rights of the Mustazafin all around the world, whether it be Muslim or non-Muslim. But now we could see that these Arab countries are very much living like the Western ones. I mean, the lifestyle, everything. I mean, their strategies, the politicians, the geopolitical decisions that they're taking, you know, is very much like the Western ones, like the capitalist, imperialist ones. And day by day, this message, we can say, is fading away. I mean, Islamic Republic of Iran and all the truth seekers, justice seekers across the world are doing their best in order to defend the rights of the Palestinians against the Zionists. But with the establishment of the ties between some of the Arab countries and the Israelis that we could see nowadays recently, I think that the enemy is getting bigger and bigger, Said Mohsen, isn't it?
Well, obviously, one of the unfortunate things that is happening in this world is that the enemies are becoming united.
Yes.
Whereas Muslims are they're having disunity.
Okay.
And that is also because of the propaganda that the enemies have. You know, that UK is the best country to, bring disunity amongst the people. And they had this slogan of divide and rule. So they're dividing the Muslims. They're buying the Muslims. And this happens, why? Because when we are not having leaders who are God-fearing, who are muttaqi, because in Islam, the criteria of becoming a leader of a country, of a state, is to have taqwa.
Yes.
If someone is not having a fear of God, then obviously he will have the fear of others.
Yes.
Then he will have he will go after the lust of this material life. So what we can see, like in the Muslim countries, there is a conflict of ideologies.
That's right.
The governments are secular. The maybe like Arab countries or non-Arab countries, yes. Like, you know, you can see like the Pakistan, it's a Muslim country. Like the governments are mostly secular, but the yes. people are so religious.
Okay.
You know, governments don't announce protests against the Zionist regime, where locally people, they come out on the streets when it's the last Friday.
That's right.
You know, whether it's a Sunni or Shia, no matter. Yes. So similarly, in other countries, this is happening.
Yes.
In the Arab countries, even, there's a conflict of, you know, worldview or the mentality that is there. On the other hand, you asked a question, like before from brother, that why in today's world we are celebrating the day of quotes and why we are having the protests. Now, this is very important to know that, you know, there are two types of supports for a person.
Mm-hmm.
One is internal, one is external.
Okay.
For the Palestinian people, where the Palestine is a slogan of the oppressed ones, and the resistance of Palestinians is the resistance against every arrogant and every oppressor, wherever it is, whether it's American or non-American, because in the speech of Imam Khomeini, he says that the nation that were under the pressure of America and the non-America. So he mentions both, like all the powers that yes. are there. So this has become a slogan, the yes. Day of Quds, as a slogan standing against the oppressors. So internally, the Palestinians are having resistance.
That's right.
But obviously, they also need an external support. They need a support from the Muslim world, from the other countries. You know, as brother has mentioned, it's the matter of rights, the human rights. So when their rights are not being observed by the Zionist regime and the world is silent on it, then on the other parts of the world, we must raise our voice. The way we raise our voices for the blacks in America.
Yes.
You know, when they killed the George
Floyd.
Yes. George Floyd.
Yes.
There were other oppressions. There were oppression in the Myanmar. We see yes. we see oppression in the Palestine. We see in oppression in Afghanistan.
Yes.
You know, wherever we see, we raise our voices. Why? Because these people need the the support. And this also shows to the oppressors that they cannot do whatever they want.
That's right.
Easily. Okay. There are resistances. There will be a resistance. If in that particular part they do not face such That's resistance, right. but on the other parts,
okay.
The people will talk about them. The people do not like them. Mm-hmm. And there is a resistance outside the specific area as well.
And the concept of resistance is for sure one of the most significant, concepts and promoters in the religion mm-hmm. of Islam that must be encouraged. Unfortunately, it is forgotten day by day. Very much we are limited as Muslims to only the rituals, obligatory ones especially, and the huquq of the mustazafin is forgotten. Inshallah, Palestine will be free one day, and all the oppressed ones all across the world. Nowadays we could see it in Yemen, in Bahrain, Afghanistan, Pakistan, in Syria, in Iraq. Inshallah, one day all the oppressed people are free. Palestine will be free soon, inshallah. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen.
You're welcome.
And Brother Yasser Ibrahim for your presence in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to the program Viewpoints on IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN/Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.